You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
On the night of November 20th, 1999, Angela Garcia, a single mother, was at home with her two toddlers. It was a quiet, peaceful evening. The girls were upstairs in her bedroom watching Rugrats on TV. Downstairs, Angela was on the phone with her family making Thanksgiving plans. Angela went up to use the bathroom, and while there, she noticed it was getting hard to breathe. She began coughing.
I knew something was going on, but I couldn't really figure out what was happening in the house.
When she came out of the bathroom, Angela saw smoke billowing up from downstairs. Frantically, she searched for her daughters, but the smoke was too thick.
I couldn't find them, and so the only thing I thought about was I needed somebody to help me.
Angela broke the window, jumped down from the second story, and ran to the neighbor's house.
I went to her house and I thought, please help me find my kids. I can't get my kids.
Both of her children died in the fire. Angela was convicted of arson and murder and given a life sentence. And then, after spending over 16 years in prison, she was faced with an agonizing choice.
I cried so hard. And I remember praying to God and asking God, like, whatever you want me to do, I'll do. Because I had to make a decision within a couple minutes that was going to change the rest of my life.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Angela Garcia. Angela Garcia was born in New York in 1977. She moved to Cleveland when she was 14.
My mom got married to my stepdad when I was really young, so he kind of raised me. I lived with him and my mom. So I have a bunch of stepbrothers and sisters, but for my mom, it's me and I have one sister. My sister Judy from my mom were 7 years apart.
She was just a little sister. She always wanted to be up under me, as little sisters always want to do.
This is Angela's older sister, Judy Cotto Nichols. And despite their age difference, the two have always been close.
I have this one memory that I always think about. My mom had, I don't know how old I was, I had been really young. My mom had bought these telephones, and we had this long hallway. And I remember us being on these, like, I think they were blue phones.
Oh my God, that is so silly. Yes, my mother had bought her for Christmas these little phones. Remember them princess phones? Well, there was two of them attached to one. She'd be in one room and I'd be in the other room. We talk on the phone. Oh my God, that is so silly.
Hi, Angela. Hi, Judy. That's like one of the memories from my childhood that is so fond in my mind.
I think we had a good childhood. You know, we was never hungry. We lived nicely.
The sisters stayed close as they grew older and both started families. Judy had a son, DJ, and Angela had two girls, Naima and Nyjah. Their children were around the same age and constantly together.
My oldest daughter was like real bubbly, real talkative, and just really outgoing. And then my youngest daughter was kind of quiet, like real observant. She would be quick to speak to people, but like she would try to get a feel of people. I always say that they were both of my characters kind of like split up and got into both of them.
Naima, was always smiling. She thought she was big sister to her little sister and my son. Yeah, she was the smart one. And Nyjah, yeah, she was the roly-poly one. She was more quiet. She was like a little Buddha. She's so adorable.
And I used to love to do the hair. I used to put like braid the hair and put beads in the hair.
And they were spoiled by everyone. They were babies that couldn't do no wrong.
How was she as a mom?
She was a good mom. Yeah. I kept the kids a lot because I had a younger son. So they can play together all the time. So basically I had them mostly all the weekends.
Angela was a single mother, 22 years old, and engaged to be married. She was raising her daughters in a two-story house she rented from her parents in East Cleveland. Judy and her family lived nearby. Angela was in school and dreamed of becoming a paramedic.
But it was like schooling was expensive. So me and my sister, we had went somewhere and we met a recruiter. And he told me like, hey, if you sign up for, you know, to be in the Navy, you know, we'll pay for you to go to school. So, I mean, I just figured, why not? Like, who wouldn't want to do that? And knowing that somebody, like, your whole schooling is going to be paid for.
Basic training would take 6 weeks. And Angela knew she would need someone to take care of her daughters during that time. So, naturally, she asked Judy.
Yeah, that's not a problem. It wasn't a problem. You know, I always say it takes a village to raise a family. You know, so we was our little village.
But, yeah, of course, that never happened.
So this case started with a fire at Angela's house on November 20th, 1999.
This is Joanna Sanchez.
I'm managing counsel of the Wrongful Conviction Project at the Office of the Ohio Public Defender.
It was the weekend before Thanksgiving, and Angela was at home with the girls.
My daughters used to love Rugrats, so we used to watch that all the time. They were 2 and 3, so it really wasn't like we were doing like a whole lot.
The house was calm and quiet. While the girls watched TV up in her bedroom, Angela lit a couple of candles and was talking with her stepsister on the phone downstairs.
And we were just talking about Thanksgiving and who's going to cook and what they're going to cook and all that. I had went upstairs to use the restroom, and my oldest daughter, Naima, she had came in the bathroom. And I told him, like, get out the bathroom. And she said something to me, but I didn't pay her any attention, whatever she was saying. And to this day, I always think about if I would have listened to her, maybe she was telling me something. Maybe she seen something, heard something, and was trying to tell me. But at the time, I didn't think anything of it.
When she came out of the bathroom, she noticed she was coughing and she saw smoke. So she kind of went toward the stairs and saw just smoke billowing up the stairs.
I knew something was going on, but I couldn't really figure out what was happening in the house. And I knew I was having problems breathing. Like I couldn't breathe.
The first thing Angela thought of was her children.
They were in my bedroom at the time. And so I was feeling all over my bed for them and I couldn't find them.
And by this point, the house was just filling with thick black smoke.
I couldn't find them. And so the only thing I thought about was I needed somebody to help me. So I opened up the window and I was screaming out the window. And then somehow I busted the window out, trying to get out. And then I jumped out the house. And in my mind at the time, I thought that if I jumped out, and found somebody to help me, I could find my daughters.
So she did break out the second story window, went on to what was the roof of the porch, jumped down to the yard, and ran to her neighbor's house to get help.
you don't think, like, I didn't think about if you jump out the window, how are you going to get back in the house? I never even thought about that. Only thing I thought about was trying to get back in, you know, trying to save him, trying to find him. And so I went to the next door neighbor's house and I thought, please help me find my kids. I can't get my kids. And me and her went back to the house. I don't remember everything that happened. I remember me and her being on the porch because we couldn't get back in the house.
Unfortunately, by the time the firefighters came, Nyjah and Naima had died. Initially, the firefighters, they looked at the house, they, you know, documented the scene. They brought in an accelerant sniffing dog who found no accelerant, and they determined that this was an accidental fire, and they destroyed the house.
What, is that normal? I thought that was so crazy. 2 days later, the house is destroyed.
It's very quick. I mean, it prevented certainly the defense from ever collecting any evidence in the house, but really no evidence was collected. I mean, they took photos, but no materials were collected for any sort of testing for accelerants or anything of that nature. So it's very strange.
So then walk me through, it's an accident, the house is leveled. How do we get to where we are?
So the house is leveled. A couple months later, Angela submitted her insurance claim for her renter's insurance, and they believed that she had overvalued the contents of her home. And so at that point, the police and the fire investigation unit started looking at this again and determined instead that this was an incendiary fire.
How do they come to that conclusion without the house?
So what they did was they looked back at some of the photographs. There's a large burn through pattern in the dining room floor. And so they believed that was the area of origin. I think when they had called it an accidental fire, the presumption had been that maybe one of the candles had fallen over and caused this fire. And so one of the fire investigating unit officers indicated that he thought now the candle was too sturdy and too far away from any combustibles to have caused the fire. And so they came to the conclusion that it must have been an intentional fire.
Angela was barely into her 20s. She had lost both her daughters as well as her home.
That whole time period, I can't even say, you know how when you're asleep and like you think you're dreaming, but you're not sure because sometimes it looks real. Some parts of the dream looks real. Some parts look fake. And that's just how I felt for that time period. You know, I was a young mom and I never really experienced losing anybody. I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know what I was supposed to feel. Now I know that I was in a real bad depression.
And then just 3 months later, in February of 2000, Angela was arrested. She was charged with insurance fraud and aggravated murder.
I couldn't believe I was arrested, actually. I was like, what? Like, this is crazy. You know, it didn't make no sense to me, none whatsoever. I knew I didn't hurt my daughters. You know, I knew I didn't. I loved them like I love myself. You know, I always believed that the truth would prevail. I always thought that if somebody got arrested, whatever they got arrested for, they did. Because that's what society teaches you to think. That's what the news teaches you to think. So why would I ever think that the system would let me down?
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
There's a lot happening these days.
but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Angela's 2 daughters, 3-year-old Naima and 2-year-old Nyjah, had died in the house fire. And on August 21st, 2000, Angela went to trial for the first time before Judge Bridget McCafferty. The state sought the death penalty. Their case hinged on the theory that Angela had burned down her house and killed her children to get the insurance money.
She had a renter's insurance policy. She had life insurance on herself. And their theory was that she burned down her house and murdered her children so that she could collect some money on those insurance policies and sort of start a new life child-free.
Remember, the year before, Angela had been thinking about joining the Navy.
And because she was a single mother, she was told you can't join the Navy with dependents. You know, so Angela looked into having her older sister, who she was very close with and very close with her children, to take temporary custody of them while she pursued this Navy career. Ultimately, Angela changed her mind and didn't do that.
Nevertheless, the state used that information at trial to bolster their narrative that Angela was trying to free herself from the responsibility of motherhood by setting fire to her own home.
They put on their fire investigation unit, a couple officers from there, and they testified about what we now know are really outdated myths that they used to use that indicated arson in their minds. So different types of char, like alligator char on the walls, burn through pattern, they put that evidence on.
The prosecution also presented an insurance adjuster to testify that Angela had recently purchased a large renter's insurance policy, as well as a policy on herself and her daughters.
The defense put on evidence that indicated she actually hadn't sought out those policies. These are salesmen who had come to her work and sort of given her a sales pitch when she had reluctantly signed up for insurance.
In addition to those witnesses, the prosecution presented firefighters and neighbors who had witnessed the events that night. They also presented a hospital worker who testified that when Naima was brought into the ER, she was wrapped in a cord from the window blind.
They alleged that Angela had tied up one of her children. There's lots of testimony that shows why she might have ended up bound in those blinds. There was testimony from the firefighters that they actually came in and they used a tool to knock out the windows and knock down all the blinds and curtains. And so those blinds would have landed on her child. The firefighter then scooped her up with the blinds, went outside with her, handed her to an EMS worker who then handed her to someone else. And so it's easy to see how during this whole process, she may have become entangled in the blinds.
The prosecution also alleged that Angela wasn't reacting properly at the hospital, that she wasn't behaving the way a grieving mother should.
You know, that's something that's really interesting about this case, because originally what the witnesses at the scene were saying was that Angela was hysterical. She was sitting on the ground. She was rocking back and forth. You know, she was screaming about her children, really, you know, couldn't be consoled. And when she was interviewed at the hospital by the firefighters and the police detectives, they wrote up a report said nothing about her demeanor, nothing out of sorts. Later, after they changed the fire to incendiary, they went back and added a report about their reflections of her demeanor that night in the hospital and said that she was too calm.
When the defense presented their case, they didn't call any witnesses to testify.
What they did was aggressively cross-examine the state's witnesses. So these trials happened in 2000 and 2001. And by then, like, fire science was starting to evolve. This guide that fire investigators use, NFPA 921, had started to debunk some of these long-held myths. And so the defense at trial really used that to cross-examine the fire investigators about, you know, all these things that they were relying on that weren't supported by science.
The first trial ended in a hung jury. A few months later, there was a second trial, which started in January of 2001, the same judge and prosecutors.
For the second trial, the state presented much of the same evidence they did at the first, but then also brought in a jailhouse informant.
That informant's name was Tanya Lanham.
Tanya and her husband, Tim, were arrested for passing bad checks, and they hit the jail at the same time. He was on the men's side. She was on the women's side with Angela. And so then she would later testify that Angela confessed to her during that time.
And as we've seen in so many wrongful conviction cases, that jailhouse confession never actually happened.
Years later, Tim would write a letter to Angela indicating that, you know, that was a lie. And what he said was that the police approached them after her first trial about testifying against Angela.
The prosecution denied that Tanya and Tim had been offered any kind of deal. But after she gave that information to the police, Tanya received a 60-day suspended sentence for the bad checks charge. That second trial also ended in a mistrial. The jury couldn't reach a verdict there either, but the state just would not give up.
By the time we got to the third trial, the prosecution had completely changed its prosecutors. They really enhanced their evidence about the financial motives. It really became a trial almost entirely about that. And they also alleged that in between the second and third trial, they had discovered a second area of origin for the fire in the house. So now they were saying this didn't just start in the dining room. There was also a pour pattern on the stairs. And so the state's theory was an accidental fire couldn't start in two different locations. They also brought on, and this is kind of maybe one of the more shocking parts of the third trial, they had a firefighter testify that he was at the scene the night of the fire, and that on the stairs, he found an intact Bic lighter that he didn't photograph, didn't tell anyone about. He just looked at it, put it back down, and never said anything until trial number three. And then the other thing the defense did in the third trial, which they hadn't done in the first two, is they called an expert witness. So they brought in Dr. Richard Roby, who is a chemical engineer and an expert on fire science. And he testified that the fire investigators had relied on outdated signs of arson. He really debunked a lot of what the state's evidence was. He described this concept of flashover that really changes how fire investigations should be conducted. And so he was really kind of ahead of his time. And the state at the third trial called him junk science and said that he had kind of created a quote, miracle theory of flashover and tried to discredit him. And they effectively did so. And Angela was convicted at the end of that trial.
By the time my second trial happened, I really believed that, you know, I had two hung juries. Okay, they're going to let me go. Because why would you still keep trying me? And it's like mentally, it starts to weigh you down. And like, you know, hearing people say things about me that's not true, or, you know, certain people call me predator and, you know, all these different type of names and stuff like that. So I was really going through it. And I just had like this overwhelmingly tired feeling. You know, I was just so overwhelmingly tired.
Joanna,
I feel like we'd think after one or two mistrials, they would just let this go. But they did not. The state kept coming for Angela. Was there something else going on?
Yeah, I think that there's certainly racism and misogyny are a big factor in Angela's conviction. You know, we often see this with women who are wrongfully convicted of killing their children. This idea that they're a horrible mother is running throughout their trial, right? And in Angela's trial, there's also a huge degree of racism. The way she was characterized throughout the trial, Angela's Puerto Rican, she was referred to as a predator, as an animal. They suggested that her family were engaged in fraudulent business or fraudulent practices without any proof of that. Jurors were interviewed after the first and second trial, and we know that the deliberations often broke down along racial lines. And so I think race was a huge undercurrent in this trial.
Angela was convicted of 3 counts of arson, 2 counts of murder, and 4 counts of aggravated murder. She was given 2 life sentences. She would not become eligible for parole for almost 50 years. When they convicted you, what did you think? I mean, that was the moment that it all became pretty real.
You know, I was in like a state of shock because when I got found guilty, I didn't believe it. I didn't believe it. How do you send someone innocent to prison when you know I didn't do this? I was like in Never Never Land. Like I was in a world by myself in my own head because I just could not believe that these people are sending me to prison for 49 and a half to life.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's 2 kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid Kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
When I was in prison, you know, sometimes women can be very cruel, you know, and people would say, oh, I would have died with my kids. I would have did this and I would have did that. But, you know, at the end of the day, no one can honestly say what they would or wouldn't do.
And so what was life like for you in prison before this happened? You were going to school. Were you able to continue with that when you entered prison?
So initially I was doing 49 and a half to life. So I wasn't able to go to school. So I just kind of like had nothing to do for the most part. And so until a gentleman that he was a teacher there, he helped me a whole lot. And he taught me a whole lot of like about construction and things like that and blueprints, just like a lot of different things. And so like he let me become his aide for the class and he let me take an apprenticeship. And so he let me weld and stuff like that. So if it wasn't for him, I don't know what I would have been doing in there. because it's so easy to get caught up in drama and all type of other stuff. So that kind of kept me out the way some.
Judy, your two nieces died, and then your sister is arrested for their deaths. What were you thinking when all of this was happening?
For one, I used to live in that house. And there was already issues going on with the electrical, and there was already issues going on. Everyone already knew that. You know, the first thing my dad said, oh my God, the electrical, you know, I should have got the guys in there. And the electrician actually went in there and he told Angela, I'll be back. So many people have guilt over this. The guy that's supposed to come back to do electricity, he had guilt. Everyone felt had some sort of guilt over this. You know, I did, because usually I get the kids on the weekends, and I didn't have the kids that day. I don't know what happened, but I didn't have the kids that weekend.
When she was in prison, were you guys still close? Did you talk often?
Ooh, yes, 110%. We was going every weekend.
Wow.
Until they changed the visitation. And it got to the point where the guards knew us. They would be like, hey, how you doing? Hi, Garcia family. Yeah, it got to that point. But we was there all the time.
You know, I didn't ask her, and I usually do, but did she struggle in prison? Did she ever tell you about any really hard times she was having in there?
She didn't want us to know anything that was going on. You know, I don't ask any questions. I told her, whatever happened in there, leave it there. Don't nobody want to relive that. You know, if she wants to share, whenever she's ready, she can share. But I told her, when you come home, you leave that there.
Angela's family continued to support her and believe in her innocence. And so did the fathers of Naima and Nijah.
Both my daughter's fathers did. Yes. Anything I needed, they were there for me. Even after we had children together, we had a good relationship. And I've talked to them through the whole time I was in prison.
In 2009, Angela applied for assistance to the Wrongful Conviction Project at the Ohio Public Defender's Office.
We had just started that year, in fact, and so it was one of our very first cases that we really dug into. And what we did is we had some expert witnesses look at the fire in light of new evidence, and particularly the shift in science related to fire investigation.
One of those witnesses was the renowned fire expert, John DeHaan. His expertise has been key in reinvestigating many other arson convictions, including Karen Bose and Deborah Nichols. We've covered them both on previous episodes.
What he found was that, again, the state really relied on unreliable factors, unscientific signs of arson. He also noted that there were other potential accidental causes of the fire that the state completely failed to consider.
And one of those possible causes ties in with something Judy told us about earlier.
They found pretty compelling proof that this was actually an electrical fire. There was what they called like an unsystemic mix of wires. And that was visible in the ceiling of the basement, the floor of the dining room. And there's evidence that there was like a low burning sustained fire in that section. They were also able to use fire toxicology, which wasn't really used in fire investigation in 1999, to show that there couldn't possibly have been a second pour pattern on the stairs. So with that, we filed a motion asking for Angela to have a new trial. And we were actually supposed to have a hearing on that in May 2016.
And then on the morning of the hearing, there was a surprise development.
The prosecution came in and they offered Angela a plea deal. And essentially what they said is, plead guilty to a lesser offense of involuntary manslaughter. We'll let you go home from prison in 5 years.
This type of plea is known as a dark plea.
Dark plea is a term that Ohio Supreme Court Justice Michael Donnelly actually coined after learning about Angela's case. And he uses it to refer to pleas that happen exactly like how Angela's did. So we think about plea bargaining in the system, and we usually think about it before trial, right? Somebody decides to enter into a plea instead of going to trial. A dark plea is one that happens after an individual has already been convicted, they're incarcerated, and they found proof of their innocence, and they're asking for a new trial. And that dark plea offer comes right at that time. The danger in it is that it's incredibly coercive. because this person has been convicted. They're living in prison. They've lost their liberty. And what they're looking at is take a risk, take a gamble on my future, and hope that the system that has wrongfully convicted me gets it right or have this certain freedom. And Justice Donnelly describes it as essentially negotiating with a gun to your head.
I always said that I'm innocent and I would never plead anything. Nope, I'm going to fight, fight, fight. However, as time go on, my stepdad passed. My mom's getting older. You know, you start thinking differently. So Joanna said, hey, they offered you something. I'm like, what?
She was like, I don't know what to do. And it was like a last minute thing they gave her, you know? Didn't even give it time to think about anything. Like what, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, not even? You know, there was like, make a decision and make it now. You know, come on, this is somebody's life. You don't just tell them, make a decision and make it now.
I cried so hard. And I remember praying to God and asking God, like, whatever you want me to do, I'll do. I can't do this on my own. I need you. You know, and that's the one time in my life that I was all by myself, but I didn't feel alone. And I'm not a very like religious person, but I felt like God's spirit with me because I had to make a decision within a couple minutes that was going to change the rest of my life.
This deal, I told her, Angela, you have all the people standing behind you. We had the workers, the kids' fathers all standing behind her. But Angela was frightened. She was scared.
I think I was 40 at the time. And don't have to worry about doing another 30-something years in prison for something I didn't do. And then, you know, what makes it even worse for me is that I didn't take my children's lives. And now here I am. I did the one thing that I said I would never do. I took the plea.
That morning, rather than face a fourth trial, Angela pled guilty to one count of aggravated arson and two counts of involuntary manslaughter. Under the plea agreement, her sentence was reduced to 22 years. She would be out in less than 6 years.
I didn't have time to think about, oh, when you get out, you're going to be a convicted felon.
Angela was finally released in January of 2022. But life isn't exactly back to normal. With the felony convictions still on her record, even the most basic things in life can be a challenge.
When you get out, you can never get an apartment because they don't rent apartments to convicted felons. You know how hard it is to get a job having a record. You know, it's so many different things that I didn't get a chance to think about, you know, and then now I, you know, of course, now I think about, like, did I make the right decision?
Well, do you regret doing it?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I wish I had the courage to fight. But, you know, all the things that I seen that happened in the courtroom, and I was scared. Did I have the mental strength to go through all that again? Did I want to take my mom through all that again? Or anybody else in my family, you know? And I just figured, like, if I took this plea, like, I could be home. I could be home with my mom. I could take her out to eat, you know? And I can lay in the bed with her and stuff like that.
When Angela first got out of prison, adjusting to her new life was harder than she expected.
When I first got locked up, I had to figure out prison. I had to figure out how and what I had to do to survive. And it's like kind of the same concept, but being free. It's not like the prison or anybody says, you know, hey, listen, here's a manual. This is life. This is what you need to do. This is how things are going to be. You know, you don't get that. When I came home, it was weird being around my friends because we were all once young. Now they're older women, and not only are they older women, but they're grandmas. Sometimes I will you know, go out with my friends and I will feel out of place. Because it's just like, I think that like when you're in prison, especially for a long time, is like, that's how you picture them. Even with my mom, like my mom's in her 70s now, but I still picture her as this 40-something-year-old woman, you know? And so like sometimes I look at my mom and she'll do something and I'll be like, man, my mom's an old lady now.
But Angela, still in the prime of her life and with a renewed sense of purpose, plans to get married and start a nonprofit organization.
Like a sober living home to help people that have been in prison, let them have a place to come to. So I've been trying to work on that. And I'm just trying to work on myself and just trying to become a better me, a better daughter, a better sister, and a better aunt.
And you're still quite young. Do you want to have kids or adopt kids or anything like that?
Me? I'm young.
I think you're 46.
Yeah, I'm knocking on 50's door. 50, like, come on in. No, I can't have any more children. After I had my children, I had complications. And that's another reason why my daughters meant so much to me, because I just felt like God gave me these two.
So let me ask you, I mean, this is so hard to talk about. So how come you do talk about it?
I talk about it because my situation can happen to anybody else out there. And I want people to be aware of the things that happen to me and to many others. I want people to understand that our judicial system is not always right. And our judicial system is not always fair. And, you know, a lot of people are not aware of all the people that have been wrongfully convicted. It's my same situation. It can be your daughter, your mother, your sister. You know, it can happen to anybody. I want people to understand that everybody that takes a plea is not guilty.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in the episode description to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our executive producers, Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wirtis, as well as senior producer Annie Chelsea, producer Kathleen Fink, story editor Hannah Beal, and researcher Shelby Sorrells. Mixing and sound design are by Jackie Pauly, with additional production by Jeff Clyburn and Connor Hall. The music in this production is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good podcasts in association with Signal Company Number One.
Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.